Okay, so for this podcast, my guest today is Dr. Chris Deasy, who is a reader in theology and religious studies at the University of Kent. And he's an author of several books, I think five books, is that right, on religion and film?
So certainly the first three were.
The first three.
Film appeared in ever-decreasing capacities. Okay.
And somewhat surprising, not surprisingly actually, after that you've convened a module on the religious studies programme at Kent called Religion and Film. That's correct, yeah. Can you give me an overview of the module, please?
Just absolutely. Well, it came out of the PhD many years ago, and I thought there has to be some sort of relationship, religion, popular culture. What are people doing with religion? What does religion mean to people? What I found is that people would often say to me things like, oh, which religious films are you looking at? Or indeed, which biblical epics are you looking at? And I thought, well, that's interesting, because that comes into my research and then the teaching. So the teaching came out of really this sort of conversation that was already going on. So the module certainly looks at biblical epics, the sort of things that people would expect religion and film to consist of. So we know what religion is. It might be about Jesus, or it might be about Gandhi, or it might be about the prophet, or Moses, or whatever it might be. And then looking at films about those personalities. But I went a little bit further than that and thought, well, what's happening when people go to the cinema? Functionally, what is the ritual that's taking place? It's a core event, maybe a transformative event in people's lives. Sociologically, it's about bringing people together. So I was looking at the emotions, the psychology of it, the sociology of it. So it's also looking at not just the simple question of, is the content of this film religious, but is there something about the act of cinema going, the process of cinema going and watching films, that might be analogous to or the same thing as a religious activity or religious experience?
So one of your weeks on the module, so I had a look at the module, it's entitled Cinema Going as a Quasi-Religious Practice. Yeah. And so what is your findings on that? What's the kind of overview? Was that part of your research that you
It certainly has come into that, because there's a figure called Ninian Smart who founded religious studies actually in Lancaster way back in the 1960s. And he came up with these different categories of what a religion is. God doesn't appear in any of those. It's about ritual, narrative, the materiality, the sociology, you know, sort of the act of going, bringing people together, the community aspect. And he had the seven dimensions of what religion was, the experiential being one of the others. And so it was a case of mapping that alongside what happens with films. So you've got the content element, obviously. You know, this film might have something in it that relates to something that you might find in scripture, for example. But yeah, in that particular week, we will look at, say, Durkheim and sociologists from the beginning of the 19th century who had the idea that religion was about social cohesion. It's about bringing communities together. He wasn't interested per se in whether there was a God, but it may well be that it was the belief in God that would have the effect of functionally, you know, doing what religion does, you know, it brings people together in society. So the question that I was raising in my research then was whether other forms of expression, other media, other rituals might have the same effect. So a sporting match can certainly do that. Shopping could do that for some people, and cinema could do that for some people. So the findings in that particular week, when we're looking at architecture, we might look at the way that churches have been cinemas, or cinemas have been churches, or in some cases they're used in a very sort of conjoined way. And actually it's great when you're teaching, because the students will sometimes say, I go to a church on a Sunday and it's a converted cinema, or it's a cinema for the rest of the week. And then you look at the architecture. I find this in old cinemas as well. You look around and you look at the decorations around, and you look at almost like the stonework. It's almost like the masonry. You almost see that there's an organ that may have been used for silent films, you know, when it was, if it's an old cinema that was, you know, 70, 80 years old. And you look around and you're thinking, especially when the screen is parted and you're sitting in these luxurious seats, ideally, maybe even a red carpet that's running between the two sides of the auditorium, and you're thinking, this is something particularly special, regal, grandiose. And then people stop talking, the screen will widen, the curtain will come back, and then you immerse yourself in this experience. So that's kind of what I was trying to get at in the research, and then obviously channel that through that module.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I love the architecture of old cinemas. There is a great blog post, I can't think what it is now, so I wish I hadn't mentioned it, but I'll find it out. A great blog that someone runs, it's just pictures of old cinemas up and down the country from inside and out. There's the old ABC in Wolverhampton was on there, which was obviously where I first started going to watch films a long time ago. What did you find, was there any correlation between people's responses in churches and people's responses in cinema? Watching films, was that part of your research?
Well, we were looking at it through literature, often looking at what people in film studies were saying often, and looking at, there was a John Belton comes to mind, who was early to mid 1994, and he was looking at American cinema and images, and he was very much looking at the architecture of it. And it's interesting as well that you'll find outside of my own subject area sort of references to the way that there is something transformative about the cinema going experience. And what I was then doing was mapping some of those accounts. In some cases, they may have been pre or indeed during Second World War, particularly periods when there was a great growth in cinema going, and saying, what are people doing here? And of course, one of the questions that comes up is, it's all about escapism. But I find that really intriguing, because you could say the same thing about religion. You know, is religion really escapism? But also, escapism suggests what? Does it suggest, you know, happy endings? Does it mean that in going to see a film that you're going for a particular purpose? Maybe it works both ways. Maybe you go to have a couple of hours of innocent fun, but then afterwards you know, Woody Allen has talked about this. Decades later, you think, why isn't life like it is in the movies? So it's looking at that sort of testimony. Actually, Woody Allen is brilliant in that regard. You know, sort of the idea that when he was growing up in the 30s and 40s, you know, you'd pay just a few cents to go to these Brooklyn movie houses, and he'd say, you know, one day you'd be fighting the Nazis, the next day there'd be cowboys, and everyone had these plush apartments, and everybody sort of spoke in a way that just seemed a little bit magical. But it's decades later, people's like, but life kind of isn't like that. I mean, it's that discordance between the REAL world and the REEL world, the real and the real, and sort of saying, and that sort of conversation, I think, has clearly informed his films. You know, he didn't like Hannah and Her Sisters, the ending, and he said he couldn't watch it afterwards because he thought the ending was a bit too happy, and yet many people would say it's his greatest film. So it's that sort of interplay, looking at what directors have said, looking at what filmmakers have said, looking at what audiences have said, looking at the IMDb, for example, or, you know, inverted commas, ordinary filmgoers might say in relation to a particular film. They might say, I saw blah, blah, blah. And many times they're talking about the content of the film, but they may also be talking about the ritual, the experience of it.
Yeah, I wonder whether there's anything in the idea of cinema or film as an educational practice as well. Certainly as we move into the kind of culture wars that we're seeing today, there's a lot of kind of attention placed on all sorts of media that doesn't give a positive or the right kind of message. And I wonder whether there's something about seeing cinema as a teacher or some form of instruction for audiences as well. And there has to be a feeling that it provides the right kind of instruction.
There's one of the people I work with in this field, he's based at the moment in Leicester, is Clive Marsh. He's written some of the books in this area. And fascinating, because this is one of the things that he is trying to look at, whether people will sometimes say, oh, I don't believe in God, or I'm not religious. Or they might say things like, oh, I just go to the cinema to relax, or I just go for the sheer pleasure of it. But he says, but they may ostensibly say that, but are they challenged? Are they edified? Are they educated? And it's not something that you necessarily choose to go and see. I mean, I always see a good balance of films. I mean, I'll go and see the fantasy films that, like The Avengers, which I never get. Everyone around me is like, you know, they get all the different subplots and they know all the characters. But I will then follow them with a more indie-based film. And, you know, if I come away from the film shocked, frightened, in awe, you know, I think of an example like Chinatown, Polanski's Chinatown, which, you know, famously was it Robert Towne, wasn't he, who said that the ending was changed, Polanski changed the ending, rather than have the light at the end of the tunnel, it's the tunnel at the end of the light. And Polanski, in an interview with Mark Cousins, was asked about this a few years ago, and his answer was, well, if you have a happy ending, people will say, oh, thank goodness for that, and they'll go home, forget about it, and, you know, carry on in their banal lives, you know. But if the ending challenges them, then they may wake up in the middle of the night and say, okay, there's a problem, you know, this is niggling away at me. And it's then the invitation to the viewer. So it's letting the viewer be part of this process. So the question that Clive Marsh certainly raises is, are viewers passive? Mm-hmm. And I give the cinema an awful lot. But while I'm there, I'm always aware of my surroundings. You know, some people say they just switch off. It's never that, but I'm aware that what I'm doing, I'm engaging with something. Sometimes I'm wondering why I'm not engaging with this. It might be to do with the seat that I'm in. It might be to do with the people sitting around me who are being a bit bothersome. Or it might be just I'm not interested in the film. Or it might just be that I'm feeling a bit tired or got something else on my mind. But it's interesting that sometimes, even if I watch the same film more than once in different contexts, maybe at the cinema, maybe on DVD or Blu-ray, or, you know, sometimes on my own, sometimes with friends, that often a particular film will resonate for whatever reason. So there's something in there, and I think, is it resonating with me in a way that each time I'm watching it, it's almost like a slice of my own life that's being unpacked, or, you know, like an onion that's being sort of unpeeled, and you're sort of watching it thinking, there's something in this, it's resonating with me, it's confronting me, it's challenging me. So I kind of feel that the director may have made this film, and it's there, and it's a static product. I mean, often films aren't, of course, because you have different director's cuts, and, you know, and often, like Ridley Scott will often go back and do something different with one of his own films. But it's what it says and what it does to the person watching it that I find intriguing, which is why I have this compulsion after the film to go and write a review. I'm not a trained film critic, that's not my job, but I feel I then, I'll watch something and I need to in some way disseminate it. It's almost as though I've said, I've sat in a seat for 2 hours, I've watched this film, it's had some impact, or maybe none at all, but whatever I think about that, I have to crystallise it, I have to concretise it. So that is what I find very interesting. It's the challenge, the invitation to the person watching the film. And I think, therefore, I learned that there is something deeply educational about that process.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's what you're talking about there is not the film portraying a message. That's talking about there's always an educational... this is an education in any experience that you have. And I think that's almost brings me back to the next question, was this idea of performance. There's something, there's a performance to going to the cinema that I don't think you get quite when you stick it on Netflix, for example. Yeah. There's a performance to go to, you have to be active to go to the cinema. You have to be active to do any kind of viewing, but you have to be active to go to the cinema, and there's an element of performance and ritual to it
And utter structure. I mean, in terms of my own autobiography, I will, I'm doing it this very evening, I will go to the cinema, I go to work by, get it right way around, I go to work by day and cinema by night, not like Al Pacino and Cruising. Yeah. And that for me is really important, that it's almost as though I go for a different sort of educational experience, but it's one that kind of dovetails with the other educational experience, which is obviously my day job. So the two kind of become fused, but structurally, I also find that I won't go to our Gulbenkian, which is the cinema. It's literally 100 yards, not even that, 10 feet away from my office, there's a cinema. But I tend to travel down to Dover, or I might go down to Ashford. Why do I do that? Because the journey there. I've reflected on this many times. Why would I choose to go to see a film? I wouldn't, you know, within a 10-mile radius, really, 20 at most. But what am I doing in that? Half an hour journey there, I can get myself, you know, I know it's starting at a certain time. Therefore, I know I have to be there by a certain time because I've bought my ticket. And then there's a particular process in front of me. I might buy some fast food or have a coffee or something. But you're right, whereas at home sometimes you think, oh, actually, no, I might be a bit bored. Well, I'll watch it maybe tomorrow. Or you get into it and you get a bit distracted and then you think, well, I'll just check my email. The great thing about going to the cinema, switch the email off, have to. You know, the phone goes off during the trailers. And then I know that whatever happens for the next 2 hours, there's something almost sacred about that time. And then afterwards I unpack all of that.
Yeah.
But I keep going back for more. I don't get bored by going.
No.
That's the interesting bit. And I will often go and watch a film, you know, for the second or third viewing. But I find that it's a ritual that I need to re-experience. And often, although I always go on my own, I often see, you know, recognise so many other people doing the same sort of thing.
Right.
And I sometimes think, well, that person's, you know, also, you know, maybe some of the cinemas have these occasions where if you're a member, you know, you sort of get advanced screenings of a particular film. And you hear other people doing the same thing, and they sit in the same seats often.
You, we're not advertising anything here, but you Cineworld.
Cineworld. Is your, and Curzon as well, but Cineworld is the one I go to most.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I know the answer to this in terms of the superficial differences between the Curzon and Cineworld. Yeah. What have you noticed anything that relates back to your research in terms of the architecture, mm-hmm. the ethos, the kind of people who go, yeah. In terms of it being a quasi-religious experience? Is there anything that might relate to that?
I've found that... There are two Cineworld cinemas I go to. One's in Ashford, one's in Dover. The new one in Dover plays, you know, if you arrive, as I often don't, but you arrive before the start time, but before they start with the adverts, they have a red light. They don't like neon, which is shining over all of the seats. So it's bathed in this. It looks...
And that's
the Dover one. It's a brand new cinema. So when you go in, there's something very majestic about it. The screen is very big. The seats are very comfortable. They're reclining, lots of leg room. The one in Ashford is a little bit different. It's very nice as well, but it's an older cinema, and perhaps not quite as plush. But there's something very regal about that. The Curzon is a funny cinema because it's got seats at the back, the last two rows, double seats. So obviously the expectation is that couples will go. But I find that, you know, the seating matters hugely. If you're on the very end of a row... and the screen is in the middle, and you're maybe sitting at an angle to the screen, that will really disorient me a bit, because I'm like, well, I'm not quite set. I like to be centre. Don't like to be too close to the front, but I don't like to be too close to the back. So it's more a case of somewhere in the middle is just right. So I'm absorbed by the screen, but the proximity to the screen is important, rather than being conscious more of the people around me. Like going to a concert. I saw Hall & Oates in concert the other week at Wembley. It was great, but I was so far at the back, I was watching them on a screen that was itself quite far away. It was a sort of looked like a great big TV screen rather than even a cinema screen. And so I was conscious that I was watching that most of the performance, and I felt quite disconnected from it all. I've sat at the back in cinemas sometimes and actually in some cases felt a bit distracted. And so I think that there is something about the proximity. So of course, the more you go, the more wily you will be and think, you know, which particular screen in this multiplex will a particular film be showing at, and then you can sort of choose your seat accordingly. So you know at least you're in the right frame, the context is right. The content is out of your hands, but at least you feel that you're not going to be in a disadvantaged position. If you're going to give 2.5 hours of your time up, you know, we were both talking recently about Dragged Under Concrete. Amazing film. I had a perfect seat. It was a deluxe screen in the Ashford Cinema.
We were actually in the same seat on different nights.
Yeah. I mean, that was just amazing. And it, no doubt, you know, it made me that I could relax into the seat, and I knew that, you know, there may have been people sitting behind and in front, but the way it was configured, that they were not within my view, and I wasn't conscious of them, anybody sitting behind me, having a distorted view of the screen because I was sitting up in the seat. So that all contributed. So I wonder if I'd have the same patience with that film, which was... in the pacing of the film itself was very slow, but because of where I was sitting, I was able to let that wash over me rather than sort of be very conscious that people are fidgeting around me or that maybe my vision of the screen is a little bit distorted by the heads in front of me. So in a way I felt that the apparatus was the architecture, if you like, was in the right place, which was just right if I was going to give a lot of time, you know, a lot of patience really to a film that requires patience on the part of the viewer. So all these things do matter, I think. If I've been at home, you might sometimes think, oh, it's a bit slow moving. What else is on? Let me just, you know, have a look through the other channels. And that's why I don't watch films at home. It's very much a cinema experience for that reason. I never leave a film either. There have been occasions I've fallen asleep, but really very, very rarely. And so normally I will give the film its due weight, the integrity that I've chosen to see this film. I might then subsequently regret seeing it or whatever, but I will, while I'm watching it, I'll see it through to the end and then let the review then sort of determine whether it was right or not to have seen that. And then, you know, sometimes people will say, what do you think of it? And that's okay, but I will give it due regard.
I saw a Dragged Across Concrete in the deluxe screen, the same seat that you were sitting, and perfect. I mean, I really love the film very, very, very much. And then I saw it a few days later at a different cinema, the Showcase in Warsaw, and I was the only person in the screen because the Avengers had been released by that stage.
Right.
And I was literally the only person in there. And it didn't. The Showcase seats in Warsaw don't have any headroom and stuff like that. So it was a far. It wasn't a difficult experience in watching the film, but it was a completely different experience to the first one. Whereas the first time, you're kind of quite elevated when you watch it. You're watching the deluxe screen at Cineworld. At the showcase, you're very much under the screen. Yeah. And so it has a, it definitely has an effect. And I think if I'd have seen Drugs Across Concrete first in the showcase, it might have been slightly more difficult.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, a wonderful film. Obviously, that film stars Mel Gibson, and we're going to come to him in a little while because we're going to talk about Passion of Christ at some stage. But I want to talk a little bit about, just very briefly really, about this idea of the distracted viewer. Whereas that used to be kind of the norm when going to the cinema, where going to the pictures was a night out.
Yes.
And what you saw was maybe less important than who you were going with and what you were up to when you were going. And I think there's something about where the curtain, that they don't put the lights on during the credits because they want to be able to sit through the whole film, which is good. But on more than one occasion, I've had to help an old lady out of the cinema while they're trying to get out and they can't see where they're going. So there's this balance between giving the film its due, but also it's just a film. Why should I give it its due? I'm out there. I might be there to drink a massive Coke or eat a massive tub of popcorn.
And that's the thing, because I remember having a conversation with someone who was working as a trainee secretary, as the title is used at the time, and I know when it was, because it was when The Exorcist was re-released in 1998, 25 years on, in the cinemas. And it was, so it would have been around October 1998. And I remember doing my PhD at the time, and The Exorcist came, not surprisingly, because of its topic. I wrote horror, religion and horror, and I was saying that I'd been to see that, and she said critically, "Oh, why would you have gone to see The Exorcist?" And I said, "Well, actually, it links in, well, a whole range of reasons why I might want to see it, but actually it does work well in terms of my research." She said, "Don't be ridiculous, there's nothing religious about it." And I was like, "Oh, well," and she said she'd seen it. I think for her, it was very much a night out. It was a chance to be scared. It was a night out with her friends. And for her, the idea that that film could have, it was almost as though it was like this clear separation, this binary, like, I go to the cinema to be entertained. When I'm at work, I'm in a different sort of mode. The two couldn't penetrate. And I think she thought she got so much out of the film, she then thought that for me to have got something different out of that film almost then might have made her need to reflect on whatever she had apprehended in the film. And I think for her it was a very clear case of, this is entertainment, this is for pleasure, this is fun, this is a night out with her friends. And for me then to say that actually it's good for my research, in some way, don't really understand quite what the motivation there was, but it disorientated her. And that I find really interesting, because for a lot of people, of course it is, it's a Friday night. They might in some cases say what's out, and they are with their friends. And sometimes, of course, I've noticed at the cinema where I once saw a film, I was actually embarrassed asking for it, these days I book online, and it was A Bad Mom's Christmas.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm never quite sure where the apostrophe was. There was no apostrophe, that bothered me for a start. And I went and said, "Can I have one please for A Bad Mom's Christmas?" And the guy said, "Pardon?" So I had to repeat that. And then I was conscious that I'd bought my ticket. I thought it very red in the face at that point. And then I stepped away. And then this group of young ladies came along and they asked for it and they went as a group. And I was conscious that I was, not just because I was a man, but I was, the fact that most of the other people there were there in groups, mostly female. And in sitting in front of me was, I don't know, seven or eight young ladies, early 20s, I guess. And halfway through, one of them said, "Come on, girls, let's have a selfie." And they did a selfie each other during the film. And I just thought, so I was more interested in them, in many ways, than the film itself, because of what had led them there to see this film. I go all the time. So in a way, it was more a case of, well, different. It's a different constituency of people. The Nun was another example of a film that I was very conscious of, actually, in that case, teenagers. And they really were distracted, and they were distracting me, because they weren't just responding to if they were screaming during the horror bits in the film, that would be engagement with the film. I completely get that. But they were just being silly with each other. Maybe they were passing things to each other or throwing things at each other. And that wrong-footed me a bit. And that, no doubt, coloured my apprehension of the film.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, the distracted audience during the Nun, because part of my, my book, The Anarchist Cinema, one of the chapters in that is on the unruly cinema and the unruly audience, and the Annabelle films in particular in France are associated when they have public screenings with kind of riotous behaviour. And there's been a couple of news reports of where the Annabelle films, I don't know what it is about the Annabelle films or the Conjuring universe that prompts this kind of distracted audience and throwing popcorn and getting into fights and people walking around and things like that. So I think that's really interesting. I mean, for a start, it attracts that kind of younger crowd. I think that could be one of the reasons. The Nun is the only one of that universe that I've seen in the cinema, and the audience that I watched it with, it was small, but it was fairly wrapped up in what was happening. So it's completely different to your experience, but it definitely reminds me of what I read about Annabelle when that was released, particularly in France.
And another thing that interests me as well, because I've only seen one of those Annabelle films, and it was maybe it was a Wednesday night, and it was a very packed auditorium, and I always think it's interesting as well that sometimes when you're watching a film, you're thinking, what actually is the demographic? Why of all the, you know, often there's a particular type of person, like Bad Moms Christmas, a particular type of person that's brought out. But I think, what made them choose to see this? Do they read the reviews and think, oh, that's one for us? Or is it through social media? Is it word of mouth? Is it just instinctively that people, you know, like with the Avengers, people are going to go and see it anyway because there's a particular zeitgeist that is there? But there are times also when it's gone badly wrong, and I can give a few examples when I've been in the cinema and aware that the people who are there kind of regret that they've gone to the film by mistake. Pleasantville, that happened in the late 90s, which I think was pitched at a sort of, I think it was probably given a 12A rating, and was pitched at younger, you know, early teenage people. And when I was there, and I thought it was a far better film than The Truman Show, which was dealing with similar themes from a few months earlier. But Pleasantville, not many in the auditorium, but those who were there, apart from me, tended to be younger. But I got far more out of that film and thought, it's interesting, because this is, I thought, a very sophisticated thing with lots of sort of issues about not just time travel, which it might have attracted people who thought they were going to go and see a Back to the Future sort of film. But there was something in there as well which dealt with issues around change and the inability sometimes with age or with culture to accept change. It's a film that dealt with the politics of the 1950s, mm-hmm. but when it was set, it was also great for nostalgia in terms of, you know, this is how things were 40, 50 years earlier. So on lots of levels, I thought it was a very clever film. Meet Joe Black is another one where I was surrounded by, again, some younger people who got very bored. But there was a scene in that where, this is a bit of a plot spoiler, but it's more an hour in rather than 3 hours in. It's a very long film. When one of the main characters dies, very surprisingly, and you don't see it coming, but they were laughing, they were shrieking with laughter. And whether that was just like the difficulty of dealing with death, or whether they just sort of, maybe they'd gone in thinking that it was going to be a lighter film than a more frivolous film than it was. And I was watching this, and I was shocked when one of the characters died. And then, and my response was not one of derision or ridicule or laughter. So again, I thought, it's interesting that I'm getting something different out of this film to what they are. Admittedly, they were a lot younger than me, but the whole demographic of that, and I think that that film itself didn't do all that well. I think the studio that made it, I think, you know, didn't make any sort of money on it, and I think, again, it may have been pitched at the wrong crowd. So again, that's an interesting angle.
I mean, I've not seen that film, but recently on Twitter, somebody isolated that scene, and it's been retweeted many, many times. I'm assuming it's the bit where he gets hit with the car.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it's Brad Pitt.
And so, and it's obviously taken on a life of its own now. It's this kind of like moment of ludicrous 90s cinema.
But it was, because it was in that mode. That was actually before Final Destination, because Final Destination had all of those in it, didn't it? Character would have cheated death. Mm-hmm. And you just think, oh, that's a relief. And suddenly the train from out of nowhere would come, mm-hmm. and obviously would splatter them. Yeah. And interestingly, Meet Joe Black was made a year before that. But when I saw the Final Destination films, because I was actually thinking, well, I've seen this first, but in a film that was made as a serious drama, a treatise on mortality.
Mm-hmm. I've got a question here. Is the theme of redemption often in films filtered through a spiritual or religious lens? And can you have a film about redemption that doesn't touch on the idea of religion? What's thinking around that?
That is the question for me, because my PhD was on redemption and film. And what happened was, I was a theologian who studied redemption in the context of Christian theology, and yet it was the film Taxi Driver which was shown for the first time on terrestrial TV in 1995, so it was almost 20 years after it was first made. It was shown August Bank Holiday, BBC Two, and there was a big fuss about this, the fact that this film, which I had seen before, but not on the television. And what was interesting is the Radio Times review of that film, and this is really what started me doing this research, was referred to Travis Bickle's spiral. It referred to the circles of hell and the redemption on the other side. It was a twisted redemption, or the redemption of a twisted soul, or Scorsese's twisted redemption, and it sort of brought hell, redemption, very sort of Dantean references too. And this sort of sense that there was something going on here, but in a film that was, despite using these very classic theological categories, was referring to something that was about Vietnam, about loss, alienation. It was about somebody who was psychopathic. It was dealing with somebody who was lauded as a hero when really he was kind of, indeed a twisted perhaps hero, somebody who was seemed to be intent on destruction as much as perhaps was on salvation. And so it was the interplay of these words, but which fitted in this context. And then, of course, it set me on this journey of looking at film reviews, and you'd see redemption used in anything from, I think, Spy Game comes to mind. I remember The Fisher King, films where the word redemption was used by a film reviewer. And it made me think, well, this is interesting because it's being used in everyday discourse, and it's being used by a film reviewer in the context of something that might be very grounded, very worldly. It might be something that where there's no obvious use or appropriation of traditional Christian language, and yet, or worship. You know, I think it was Amy Torbin in her review, in a book that she wrote on Taxi Driver, said, we don't see any churches in Travis Bickle's world, but grace or redemption, sin, is completely operative. So it's working, it's like a secular analogue of that. And of course, Scorsese's Catholicism, and the fact that Paul Schrader wrote the screenplay and his Calvinist background, made me think, well, what's going on here? So that was my way into this. So it was more a case of saying, rather than look at The Last Temptation of Christ, which is the obvious go-to, that was the film that, you know, at the time I was doing the PhD in the mid-90s, it was only sort of 7 or 8 years after that controversy was, so it was kind of fairly current. And yet, for me, I thought, well, people will go to The Last Temptation of Christ as the sort of obvious film where he's dealing with Jesus. But a lot of his other films have been the precursors to that. Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, they're all in different ways. Absolutely. It's sort of all that sort of sense of people who are aware that they're headed for damnation in some cases, and they know that they're damned, but they can't help it. And they're seeking some sort of release or catharsis. And in some cases, like in Mean Streets, as you say, the role of the church is there, but is that sort of being torn by the streets and torn by the church? And the two, in a way, are kind of indistinguishable in some cases, about they're both, that they're sort of polar, that they're sort of polar opposites, but they're also completely caught up in the very, in a very sort of nebulous sense, in the sort of world of, well, competing pressures, and you don't quite know which one to choose. And I think that, and you don't quite know that the, you know, for Taxi Driver, a good example, he's lauded as a hero at the end of that for rescuing Iris, but we also know full well that he actually tried to kill a presidential candidate. So he's the saint and he's the sinner at the same time. I found that very fascinating. And of course, for me then, I was stepping away from people who were talking about how faithful or not Last Temptation was to the biblical story. And then we know it was based on Kazantzakis. We know that it was a fictional exploration of the dual nature of Christ. But I was finding those same themes resonating in places that were films that people who might have had a, inverted commas, a problem with a, quote, religious film, or they wouldn't go to see a film because they don't want to spend 3 hours watching a film about Jesus, in the same way that, as I say, someone I knew in the late 90s didn't want to, couldn't entertain the thought of The Exorcist being a film that could have anything to do with religion. but these were films that were being watched anyway, but there was something going on where people were engaging with this. But if you said to them, this is a deeply religious film, they'd say, no, it isn't. Or they might say, oh, well, actually, I went to see this because I just wanted to switch off, or I just wanted to have, you know, something to engage me, but not necessarily to be edifying in that sort of sense. So I found that redemption was my way through this. And I found it fascinating that the word redemption, the way that the different characters in these films were their lives were being explored, their trajectories were unfolding, completely mapped or could be seen in some way to be analogous to or functionally equivalent to what was going on in classic Christian theology.
So here's a question. What would you say is your favourite film about Jesus?
I do have a soft spot for King of Kings, because I think it's very passionate, it's very grounded, and it actually works as a very solid drama with different and very charismatic Jesus in that. When I saw it, actually I saw it with my students about 10 years ago, or a clip from it, and it made me think of Bill Clinton, the Sermon on the Mount, and I just thought, I completely get it, in a way that the greatest story ever told is the opposite there, where he's this very standoffish, very detached Jesus, who's almost frustrated that, you know, he knows everything that's going to happen, and people are asking him questions, and they don't understand, they're mere mortals, and he sort of almost is like, he's completely attuned to the divine plan, and he doesn't want to sort of go to the bottom of explaining it to everyone. That's a real cut, you know, a standoffish film. That's the opposite. King of Kings I really like, but I do like The Last Temptation of Christ. Mm-hmm. But because I'm familiar with so many of other Scorsese's films, I don't think it's his best film. I know he made it on a very low budget. It was a complete passion, a real labour of love for him. But I would, if I had to, and, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar is good in many places. But again, I think you have to be in the right kind of frame of mind for that one. It's a bit niche.
Yeah.
So,
what do you like about that one?
Well, Jesus Christ Superstar. Yeah. The great thing about that film is the way that it brings Judas centre stage. And is it really about Jesus' struggle, just like Last Temptation, really, or is it about Judas's? Is it what Judas wants in Jesus, how Judas sees Jesus? And it's the whole question of celebrity. You know, is somebody going to, well, save us from ourselves? It's the very topical sense about charisma, personality, fame, where it leads or doesn't lead. How interesting at the end of that film, isn't it? Jesus who doesn't get on the bus. Is it Judas? Is it Judas who might even be resurrected? He sort of comes back at the end, having died earlier.
Or Judas gets the song.
A resurrection scene. Gets the song at the end.
Judas gets the song. Jesus Christ Superstar.
So that was a really challenging film, because it told the Jesus story through the lens of one of the other characters. And we've seen the same with Mary Magdalene in that film that came out with Joaquin Phoenix, wasn't it?
Yeah.
About a year ago.
Yeah. So, in terms of Last Temptation of Christ, then, what do you think of what is that not his best film? Why is that not Scorsese's best film?
I think for me it was the controversy that I could never... When I watched that film, I was just too aware of what other people were saying about it and how they were dismissing it. So I think, unfortunately, I sort of went in kind of knowing that this film had too much... It was almost as though, actually, I think it had ruffled so many feathers that kind of I couldn't go in on its own terms and enjoy it. It was almost as though it had already been boxed, and people were always then saying, what do you think, and I kind of felt then I was playing second fiddle, or I was almost like playing catch up, that the film, that it was almost as though the contours of the film had already been set out. And what I liked about some of the other films is that they challenged me in a different way, and I kind of felt like I was able to put my own signature on those. Last Temptation was very good. It was made on a very small budget. And I think that, for me, the controversy around that film is in itself deeply fascinating. The film in places is actually far more pedestrian. Actually, in some cases, it's quite dull. And I think he's playing, you know, there's some scenes when you're horrified that, you know, if you're used to films like Greatest Story Ever Told, you might be horrified that this is a Jesus who's self-doubting, he's neurotic, he's schizophrenic even. And it's Judas who is the principal antagonist. In that sense, it is similar to Jesus Christ Superstar, but on a much more kind of full-on way. And I like all of that, and it's very good. It's a long film, and it's a film that is rewarding on many levels. But I kind of feel that because Scorsese had dealt with some of those themes in a more secular context elsewhere, that film itself almost seemed to be had lost its luster a little bit, because I kind of felt he'd already made that film in so many other capacities. And in that case, I was automatically comparing it to great works like Raging Bull and Taxi Driver.
I think there's a difference, though, and if is that I think it's an utterly devotional film, in that, unlike a lot of Scorsese's films, I'm not the one who noticed this, but Scorsese's films are characterised by the main protagonist who at the end has learnt absolutely nothing and is still the same character as they were at the start. No matter what they've been through, they haven't been cured of it, and maybe they don't, or maybe they do, but they don't really get the redemption. If you think of the end of Wolf of Wall Street, he's not really learned and he's not really been punished for what he's been through. Yeah. That's just one example. Whereas I do think at the end of Last Temptation of Christ, he does go back onto the cross at the end. It doesn't end just before that point. Yeah. It does end with Peter Gabriel's music, which is very uplifting and very powerful. And again, to use the word devotional, I think.
You know, I think that's a really important point, because I know in Taxi Driver, opinion is divided, because at the very last scene when he sees Betsy again and he takes her in the cab, is this a dream sequence? Is he really complete? You know, she gets in the cab with him and he's growing his hair back and he seems, we think, maybe a bit more stable. He's back to his old self, but then there's that glint in the eye and you see the mirrors, the reflection of the mirror, and the red eye. I think at one point his eyes look very red. It's almost as though he's still disoriented and is this a charade. Is this a dream sequence? Did he actually die at the earlier scene after when he's been taken out of the building after shooting the pimps when trying to rescue Iris? And the film works on many levels, and you're right, but because Raging Bull, people use that quotation from John, is it chapter 9, about, you know, once I was blind, now I can see. Because at the end, this is a very inarticulate character who expresses himself through violence. And at the end, there is a sense that he recognises the damage that he's done.
Okay.
But his arc, considering where he's come from, this is a character who's inarticulate. This is a character who kind of isn't very educated. This is a character who has expressed himself almost in a sort of base, almost bestial sort of way. You know, he'll punch his wife, he'll punch his brother, and he seems to have issues with being able to express himself. But at the end, the arc for him he's a huge one, considering where he's come from. And it's therefore very sort of almost realistic. It's in keeping with that character. And I think that is, it's not a tacked on happy ending,
but it's a
redemptive, it's a transformative experience, but all the more surprising considering where he has come from. So it's not sort of using a traditional over the top Hollywood ending, because of course he's made those sort of films, or in an ironic way, think of New York, New York. So I think you're right in that. And I found the same with Cape Fear, which actually probably is my favourite Scorsese film.
Is that true?
Oh, absolutely, because of what he does with the original Cape Fear. Spielberg was originally earmarked to make the remake of Cape Fear, and Scorsese at one point was considered for, I guess it would have been Schindler's List, actually. And, you know, that was a very early stage in the project. But Scorsese took a genre piece. It was at that point, it was his most successful film to date. But he turned everything on its head, including getting some of the original cast, Gregory Peck, Robert Mitchum, and getting them to take on roles that were the opposite of who they played in the original film. And then the central character in the remake, Nick Nolte, was utterly, he's a womanizer. He lies to his wife, and, you know, everything is sort of turned upside down. And at the end of that film, you have Juliette Lewis's voiceover, in which she's really saying, well, we moved on. We almost like found some sort of, we were able to deal with this trauma by not talking about it. Thought, well, you need to talk about it to move on. So in so many ways, all the language was there, the right, but it was sort of all kind of inverted. It was all turned on its head. So I found that it took a stock Hollywood thriller and made it all the more interesting by also, of course, having biblical references in it, like, you know, check out the Bible Council of the book between Esther and Psalms. So Nick Nolte is like, what does he mean by that? And he realizes it's the book of Job, he reads the book of Job, and he, in a sense, is the Job character. So Scorsese did a really, although of course Job was a righteous man, whereas Nick Nolte's character isn't, but he then undergoes an arc. But what he does, of course, is to try to destroy KD, and of course that completely go, because the more he tries to get rid of him, the more he compounds his own guilt. And that's why people might say, oh, it's ridiculous, because at the end Max Cady's superhuman, and, you know, he withstands attempts to burn him, to drown him, everything, but symbolically he comes, you know, everything that Cady represents exposes the sin, the guilt in not just Nolte but the whole character, the family dynamics. And if at the end of it the family in some sense artificially or just temporarily is in some way restored, then there's something in that that I think is in keeping with the ending of some of those other Scorsese films. Sort of ambiguous redemption, But maybe it's saying to the viewer, what do you think has just happened? Rather than saying, oh, that's a relief. Gosh, he's been destroyed at the end. We can all go home and like a Columbo episode. It's okay, the killer's been gotten rid of. We can all relax and everything goes back to normal and society has been restored to its rightful place.
Yeah. I suppose some of that, what you're saying there, the ambiguity of it, is also in keeping with the kind of film noirish origins of the original. So, what do you think of The Passion of the Christ then? I'm a huge fan of The Last Temptation and The Passion of the Christ. I'm just artificially comparing them just because they're based around Jesus. But for me, I love the Passion of the Christ very, very much. I think it's an extraordinary film that hasn't really been given its due. But what's your opinion?
When it came out, it's interesting because I was writing a book at the time for Ashgate, and the controversy around the film was happening at the time that I sent it off, and they said, actually, could you write an extra 10,000 words, and why don't you cover The Passion of the Christ, because it's what everybody is talking about. So they asked if I could sort of turn it around within, you know, a fairly short time scale. So I went to see the film. Very interesting that I was at the time, I would have been about 31. I was conscious that all the other people in the audience were significantly older than me. I think a lot of the people had probably gone to see that film because they had heard that it was, you know, you had Anne Widdecombe sort of, you know, so people who wouldn't normally, you know, say that a violent film was good to go to. Kill Bill Volume 2 was out in the cinemas at the same time, and I thought it's interesting that they both deal with some of the same themes, but Kill Bill, some of the critics who were decrying that film's violence were happy to indulge, you know, Mel Gibson in The Passion of the Christ. So when I went in, unfortunately, just as with Last Temptation, I sort of went in kind of knowing that there were two things that people were complaining about. One was the alleged anti-Semitism, the other was the excessive violence. So again, it was a film that I went in kind of feeling that I had to have a position on this. And it was a bit, it also is the sort of film that, because it was a bit sort of in your face, shall we say, it kind of made me think this is fine, but there are so many more subtle films out there that aren't getting the attention. And I think that Mel Gibson did, you know, the plus side of it is that, yeah, it's set during the last days of his ministry. It didn't do what some of the other Jesus films did, which is try to cover everything, and they become very dull, almost because you've got, not all of them, because I know the Jesus of Nazareth TV series gives you all the birth narratives, because it can at least, what was it, like 11 hours, 13 hours, something like that. But so many of the films start with Jesus as a child, the ministry, you have many of the signs, you have particular key moments in Jesus' ministry, or the Sermon on the Mount, and then you have the passion, the betrayal, the crucifixion and the resurrection. Whereas his film has a few flashbacks to some of those earlier moments. But I think it was a very innovative film for the fact that it really said we're going to focus on the end of Jesus' time. And I think giving it that sort of focus made it a far more dramatically interesting film. Because when you normally go to the cinema, you know, maybe that's why I don't always like biopics so much, because sometimes they will try to give you everything, or sometimes they will leave bits out. But in this case, I think it worked very effectively. It gave you flashbacks, so you needed to know all that you needed to know about the character, but there was enough in there to make the passion itself the focus of this film, and it definitely gave it a focus and a drive which so many of the other Jesus films lacked, because they tried to cover so much, and I think we're a bit flaccid as a result.
What did you think of the inclusion, Gibson's inclusion of the devil into the narrative?
Remind me, is the devil appearing through?
The devil appears as a bald female character.
Because doesn't Scorsese do the same thing with the young girl in The Last Temptation of Christ?
I suppose the difference would be, and it's the first time I thought about it in that context, was that. I don't know if it's gendered female in the film, the devil. Yeah. I think it is played by a woman, absolutely. But I don't know whether you're aware that she's a woman within the story.
And again, because I haven't seen The Passion of the Christ. Interestingly, actually, I certainly saw it in April 2004. I may have watched it once, so I've certainly shown clips to the students. I don't know if I've watched it all since. Again, that's interesting, but it's almost as though in seeing that and writing on it, I'm sure I will go back to it at some point, but for this film, I think it, I kind of felt I got so much, I got out of it all that I needed to see, and I read everything on it. It's one of those films that I think I need to go back to after a passage of time. And that's interesting, because it's a film that many people have seen. Some of my students will talk about how one of them is of Nigerian descent, and she says that with her family, every year it's a ritual for them that they have to watch it on, I think it might actually be Christmas Day. It might be either Easter or Christmas, but really? It's something that every year that they do. But they never—it's just something that they've always done since probably 2004, 2005, and it's a ritual that they feel they have to go through. And I find that really interesting. That the film was almost as though, without knowing why they're doing it, they feel that this film kind of ticks all the boxes and has become a religious event in its own right.
Well, I think it was, and I think the fact that I think they released an edited version of it as well at one point, so younger people could go and watch it. And I think it made an extraordinary amount of money. I mean, it was an absolute blockbuster, really. But what's fascinating is, one, it's finding somebody who watches it in the kind of people I meet, in the kind of people you meet in religious studies. Maybe you see far more of them. And two, it had such massive controversy. Yet people don't seem to have that strong an opinion on it, really. I think so. That's the other thing that people have either not watched it, or they've said that they watched it and they didn't think that much of it, which I find amazing, because I think it's one of the, I think it's incredible in terms of its use of imagery and its what it attempts to do, and it makes an interesting counterpoint with The Last Temptation, I think. And I think it's something you mentioned in one of your lectures on it, on the biblical epics, where you've got the religious groups in America campaigning against The Last Temptation of Christ, but campaigning for the Passion of the Christ. And maybe that was one of the reasons why, kind of, let's be honest, liberal academic types pull away from something like the Passion of the Christ.
Yeah, and that's right. There was a book written, which ironically came out in 2003, before the Gibson controversy, and he was saying that the last film about Jesus, or the last major film, is The Miracle Worker or Maker, was made in 1999,
2000.
The animated one. But The Last Dimension of Christ has been the last Jesus film to have been made, and it was the film that was obviously made that the liberal elite were lauding it, but of course it was the evangelicals who you know, there are many scenes of. I show it with my students sometimes. There was a nun at the time who was saying, "This film is blasphemy. It's the work of Satan. You must never go and see it." And, you know, I think one of my students said, "I bet she's never watched it." You know, again, it was like, well, we know it's a David Cronenberg's Crash did the same thing. Politicians, John Major saying, "You know, he never watched it." Yeah, he was like, "Well, this sounds terrible." Film. And I think that fascinating book. It was written in 2003, which was looking at the fact that the liberals had won that particular debate. But then a year later, we then had, you know, the boot was on the other foot, and some of the same people who were denouncing Last Temptation were happy to applaud the latter.
Yeah.
And in some cases, one particular quite prominent Jewish film critic who was castigating the people who were criticising Gibson's Passion. It was a great film, but he's somebody who writes very conservative reviews of films, you know, talking about whether they're family friendly or they're okay for, you know, audiences to watch, because they don't have too much sex or violence or profanity in it. So there were some people who almost were sort of, Anne Widdecombe, another example of a politician who was actually saying good things about Gibson's film, but, you know, she's not going to say go and see Lethal Weapon, or I don't think she'd think much of Dragged Under Concrete. But this film did it, but it had huge violence in it. So either Gibson was laughing at everybody and saying, "Look, I've got all these people to go watch this very violent film," or because of the subject matter, people were saying, "Well, we'll put on hold, we'll dispel, we'll almost sort of like put on hold our normal sort of sense of, you know, the unsuitable nature, the unsatisfactory nature of violence in film, because the violence was being used for a good purpose rather than used in a self-destructive way that would perhaps arguably characterise a lot of Gibson's previous output." So I found that controversy, if anything, perhaps as fascinating, if not more so, than the film itself.
So to wrap up, do you just want to tell us a little bit about either where you see your module, Religion on Film, going, or what it is that your research is going to move into?
Yeah. Well, what I did, because for many years I thought, well, this is my research area, so I was looking at biblical epics, I was looking at Jesus films and looking at some of the controversies around those, and all the things we said already about the architecture of cinema. But in later years I found that my research was moving into other directions, which was... not necessarily looking at the film first and foremost, but looking at something like Christmas, because I wrote a book on Christmas a few years ago where I was fascinated by the fact that people will often say, oh, Christmas is a secular festival, or it's a festival of consumerism, a materialist festival, although that in itself, looking at Marxism, you know, that doesn't not make it religious. It can be a religious festival of consumption. But what I thought was really interesting is that film comes into this, because what do people watch at Christmas time? They watch films about the supernatural. They watch films about Father Christmas and analogues of heaven or Lapland and angels and elves. They all appear in this. So it's almost that we put on, you know, it's almost that we suspend our disbelief. We may be secular, rational-minded people, but at Christmas time, we indulge the supernatural outside the boundaries of the church. So I think even if people are, inverted commas, not so much religious anymore, they're going to the cinema to get a taste of the supernatural, and they're almost in that sense bypassing the church for so doing. So that's one of the directions my research has moved into. And I also worked on life after death, and looking at films, what films were saying about life after death, the way that in many cases they were looking at reincarnation. I think of that film with Meryl Streep and Albert Brooks from the early 90s, Defending Your Life, which completely mixes up heaven and reincarnation, and in a way that, you know, you wouldn't really do if you were studying Buddhism or Hinduism or Christianity. You perhaps would be a bit more careful with your categories. But filmmakers are just sort of going out and presenting very creative imaginations, you know, sort of surrounding the way they conceive of the afterlife. So again, what can theologians learn from filmmakers? What can filmmakers learn from theologians? So those are some of the directions that my research went in after the original PhD, and indeed after I devised that Religion on Film course.
Chris, that's been absolutely wonderful. I really enjoyed chatting with you. Hopefully we'll do it again sometime when we can think of some other subjects. I'm sure there'll be plenty that we can come up with. Thanks very much for that. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.